Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So the last 6 weeks, Tanti Tapo and I have been on Tudong. We left Abhayagiri on June 1st, and we traveled on foot to Pacific Hermitage in White Salmon, Washington, a distance of just over 600 miles. And we were on the road for 37 days, and we were offered hotel rooms 6 times, 6 nights in hotels. We stayed in people's houses or were under a different sort of roof about another 7 days on top of that. And we traveled on foot, as far as covering miles on foot, we walked about between 250 and 300 miles on foot, and the rest was short rides here and there. Specifically, people seem to offer rides at dangerous sections of highway. But actually, none of those numbers or statistics matters at all, and they're just not even important. But what was important was the experience. And the experience was very special, far more special than either of us could have imagined beforehand. And the practice of going on Tudong is a practice of facing uncertainty. And so each day was completely, absolutely uncertain. And the whole walk, the whole Tudong for myself just really highlighted why I choose to be a monk and why I choose to live as a samana. Because, like Ajahn Chah said, a samana has no future, and that's just really, really highlighted, was really highlighted on this walk. Everything that happened was completely unexpected. And then when something happened that was completely unexpected, we would think that was so unexpected that something more unexpected than that couldn't possibly happen. And then the next day, something more unexpected would happen. And then every day was the same. It was just more and more unexpected. So I'll just start from day one, and I'll be skipping forward a bit, because it would take probably 6 or 7 hours to tell every story there is. But I'll just start with day one, because that was significant in its own way. Because we walked out of Abhayagiri after the meal. We just started walking north on Tamkai Road to where Tamkai Road becomes a dirt road. And JR walked with us for the first 4 miles, 5 miles, something like that. When we got to the dirt road, Tamkai Road, it was about 2 or 3 p.m. That was our first spontaneous offering. Somebody in a truck, a four-wheel drive truck on the dirt road part of Tamkai Road, where you almost never see any people, stopped and just handed out of his window 3 granola bars to us. And so that was the first offering of the trip. And we couldn't eat those because it was afternoon, but we gave them to JR to take back to the monastery as evidence. That day, we walked about 13 miles into Willits. We were very, very sore in our shoulders from carrying our 30 pounds of gear each, and weren't used to that yet, so the shoulders were very sore, and we're thinking, how are we going to do this? And our Zen friend in Willits, Steve Kies, put us up that first night. That part of the Tudong was planned. That was the one plan, and that was we were going to stay at his house on the first night. And he had put out on a Mendocino County community bulletin board that we were going to be there and saying there was going to be a potluck the next day. So the next day, day two, for that potluck, you know, maybe about 20, 25 people ended up showing up, and they had read the bulletin board, and a whole assortment of people, local people from this low-income housing that Steve lives at. They came out, offered food. Group of young men and women from Hearst, a town just north of us, they showed up. They offered food, and someone from the city of 10,000 Buddhas, and just various people came together, offered food at the potluck. A paraplegic Lutheran minister showed up and had some interesting conversation with him, which we won't go into here. And then chatted with people for a while, and that was kind of our send-off. And about 15 people walked with us for the first 2 miles with Steve, with his Zen staff with bells on it. The young people from Hearst, a woman pushing her child in a stroller. So it was kind of almost like something out of Monty Python. So that was a kind of our send-off, and they walked to the edge of Willits with us and then turned back, and two people of that group walked for about four more miles with us. And they're locals from Willits. They lived there for 33 years, and they said they'd never walked out of Willits like that. They'd never walked on the highway like that in all the time they were living there. And then a car stopped, and it was this woman. She stopped and she said, would you like a ride? And we said, well, we're just starting this walking pilgrimage of ours, and we decided we're not going to take rides yet because we'd like to walk some number of miles before we decide to take rides. And then she said, well, 4 years ago, my 16-year-old son died walking on this section of road, and I would be really upset if I couldn't give you a ride. So we did accept that ride. And then she showed us where her son had died. And then she took us all the way to Laytonville and then was very, very keen on offering things. So she offered us some allowables. She offered some cheese and gave us like 2 cartons of juice for that afternoon. And then she took us to just a random point on the highway where the highway was quite a bit wider, had more of a shoulder, just past Laytonville. So we kept walking from there. And so this is still day two, and we're already north of Laytonville. And so we walked for a few hours, and it was getting late. It was like 8 p.m., but it's still plenty of light out. And we stopped to rest at a place on the side of the highway called Area 101, and all these buildings had like UFOs painted on the side of them, and there was a big like quasi-Hindu Buddha shrine, and you would never see this place if you were driving. But then there was this kind of unknown guy mowing the lawn, and he was the only sign of humanity. So we stopped there. There was bathrooms. We used the bathrooms. We rested for a bit, drank some juice, and then continued on. And then we were thinking, where are we going to camp? Because this is kind of overgrown on both sides. We weren't sure where we were going to sleep. And after we had walked a few more miles, another car stopped, and it was a young woman. She looked like she's African-American, in a dress, looked like she was going to a party or something. And she got out of her car, and there was like this kind of African drum music blaring out of her car. And she said, would you guys like a ride? I would never normally pick up men, but you guys look safe. So would you guys like a ride? So we said, well, sure, maybe you could take us to the next campground. And so she said, oh, sure. And so she then gave us a ride, and she explained that she was on her way to Garberville to teach a college course in primal crafts, and what that includes is a large part of it is Neanderthal rope making, and she was kind of explaining that to us. And it was just really interesting. I didn't even know such a thing, such a class existed. Primal crafts. So we got, I can't remember her name, but we just referred to her as the primal crafts lady. And yeah, she was keen to offer food, but as you know, it was in the evening, we told her we couldn't accept food. And she took us, the next campground was in Leggett, so she took us all the way to Leggett, Standish Hickey Campground. Just north of Leggett. And so it's getting dark, and she let us out, and we kind of wander into this campground, and the ranger lady is there, and I approached her and said, "Is there any free campgrounds in the area where we don't use money and we might be able to stay?" And she said, "No, there's no free campgrounds, but go ahead and make yourselves at home." And so she just waved us in, and that's where we stayed. Night two was at Standish Hickey Campground in Leggett. So we jumped forward about 40 miles that day. But then after that, nobody picked us up for 5 or 6 days. We walked all the way from Leggett. In the next 5 days, we walked all the way from Leggett to halfway through Avenue of the Giants, completely on foot. We stayed two nights at Standish Hickey because that day two was pretty draining, so they allowed us just to stay for 2 days. We just camped there. I had to make some modifications to my Boracan, and Eel River was there, so we went swimming in the Eel River and had a day of... Day three was kind of a day of... We went alms around in Leggett at a small shop there, got some food, and that was kind of a rest day, meditation day. And then on day four, we started walking very early. We started walking at 6 a.m. And we absolutely had no idea what was going to happen because the next big town was Garberville, which was, you know, 22 miles away. And there was some little dots on the map, a place called Piercy, Benbow, little dots on the map. We weren't sure what we would find there, but we thought that's our only hope of getting food. So we started walking at 6 a.m., walking, and we ended up walking 16 miles before we got to a place where we could go alms round, and it was really getting close to the cutoff, like thinking, you know, there's not much time for us to get food here, and we were really, really hungry, too, after walking in the sun for 16 miles. So we stopped at a Patriot gas station before the town of Bembo, just before Richardson Grove. And we were really doubtful, thinking, but this is only our only chance. So we were standing at the gas station outside of this Quickie Mart and standing there, and some people are saying hi to us, and it's getting closer and closer to midday cutoff where we can't eat anymore. And then this guy comes up to us and he says, "Oh, what are you guys doing? And can I offer some money?" And we explain we don't accept money, we accept food. And he's like, "Oh, I'll get you something." So we're like, "Oh, great." And he goes into the Quickie Mart and he comes out with a very small bag of trail mix. and he offers it to us. And he's like, "Well, you know, I hope that's enough." And we're like, "Well, you know, whatever you want to offer." And so we chanted a blessing for him, and we're thinking, is this going to all we're going to eat today? And so then we're like, "Well, we'll stand 15 more minutes and see, because it's getting closer. It's like 12:30, 12:40. And then this guy who's getting gas, this college student, he calls over to us. He says, "Hey, what are you guys doing? Who are you? What are you?" I said, "Well, we're Buddhist monks. We're on a walking pilgrimage from Ukiah to White Salmon, Washington." And he says, "Oh, really? Can I offer some support?" And we said, "Well, we're seeking food." So he says, "Oh, really? Oh, come over to my car." So he explained that he's a poor college student. His mother just loaded him up with groceries, and he starts just loading our bowls with canned food. So our bowls were just overflowing with canned food. And he said, yeah, is that going to be enough? He gives us a jar of peanut butter. He's just tuna. He's just everything you could imagine. And we said, well, you just made our day. We're really, really hungry. And but also there wasn't much time, so we chanted a blessing for him, and then we went right to the side of the Quickie Mart, sat down, and then we were like, do you have a can opener? We didn't have a can opener. So we added this little Leatherman scissors, and we're just like tearing into these things and opening them with our scissors as fast as we can, pouring it into our bowls, and we were just eating as fast as we could before the midday cutoff, and we just ate just in time. And we ate a full meal, got full that day. And we were sending little updates to people. And if anybody is wondering the story behind this, like all these empty, jaggedly open cans, that's the story behind that picture. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was a highlight, getting food that day. And then we camped in near Richardson Grove, really beautiful spot on the Eel River. And by this point, we're thinking, this is day four, and this is, like, incredible, and this is amazing. And so, we were really happy that day. And then, of course, we were thinking, you know, it can't get more strange than this, unexpected than this. But the next day, we walked to Garberville, and we went alms around in Garberville. And we stayed outside of a market. It was very normal. I mean, people started offering food, asking what we were doing, and lots of people offered us food, sandwiches, fruit outside of the supermarket. But a highlight of that was a homeless guy wanted to offer food, and he said, "Well, the way I normally eat is they throw out all this great food in the dumpster. You know, they just have a rule that if it's the bananas or over 3 days old or whatever, they throw them away." And he's like, "I know there's 50 pounds of bananas in that dumpster, and you guys eat bananas." And so he said, "Well, we can't go in. We only accept what's handed to us." And he said, "Okay, I'll be right back." So he goes and jumps in the dumpster and gets a huge, like, 20-pound bag of, like, day-old food from the dumpster and, like, offers it to us. And so we ended up not eating it because there was fruit flies on it. it was a bit smelly, but it was what he eats, and it was pretty amazing that he offered it. So that's how we got food that day. And we ended up collecting our food together. We waited till nobody was looking and quietly put the food he gave us back in the dumpster. And then walked to a freeway exit and had our meal at the edge of the freeway exit, and then kept walking. And that was a really difficult walk that day because it was very sunny and we had no place really to wash our bowls or rest. Our bowls were still dirty. And we kept thinking, well, the Eel River, you know, should be around somewhere. But then we got out our map and we could see that the Eel River goes away from 101 at that point. So we walked several miles after the meal with our bowls still out, and then we finally came to a place where there was a stream going under a bridge, so we went under the bridge and we took a rest, really exhausted, and it was really hot out on the highway. And then we washed our bowls in this stream, took a break, rested, had a coffee, and just tried to think of what to do, where we were going to stay. And then we looked at the map again, and we said, oh, where we're at now, the Eel River comes back. So we walked like literally 500 feet down this stream, and it meets the Eel River again. It's like, wow, we're on the Eel River again. So we just walked up the Eel River, and we were just fording the Eel River back and forth and just having a great time walking up the Eel River. And we ended up camping out in the open on the edge of the Eel River that day without using our mosquito nets or anything. And it was really, really nice on the edge of the Eel River there. We could swim and do our laundry, anything we needed to do. And so the next day, we climbed up a steep hillside back to 101, kept walking, and we reached Avenue of the Giants that day. And so we were really happy about that. We're in Avenue of the Giants. It's very shady. We can walk at our leisure. But we're still kind of wondering, what are we going to do for food? Because there's these little dots on the map. There's Phillipsville and Miranda and these little towns in Avenue of the Giants, but we have no idea what to expect. So we were thinking, if we can't get food at Phillipsville, which is at the beginning of Avenue of the Giants, we probably won't eat this day. So we get to Phillipsville. It's maybe 9 in the morning, and there's some trailers. There's a little rundown supermarket with like one car parked in front of it, but no visible people around. And so we're thinking, well, this is going to be our alms round, and we can stand out in front of this market, but we're not really expecting anything to happen. So we prepare our bowls and get our robes on for standing for alms food. Right after we get our robes on, like literally as soon as we have our robes on, a homeless man sitting at a picnic table near the market just calls us over, and without asking us who we are, without asking us what we're doing, without asking us if we're looking for food, he says, "I have something for you." And he just opens this bucket that he has, and he just gives us a huge jar of unopened peanut butter into our bowls, a large bushel of fresh apples, and a large bag of fresh carrots. And it was all that he had. It was all of his food, and he just gave it all to us. And then after that, he asked what we were doing, and that was very, very moving, because it was just a very pure offering. It had no strings attached. It wasn't dependent on us being Buddhist monks. He just saw us, and he felt something, and he was moved, and he offered all of his food to us. And we were speechless. And then he explained that he used to be in a biker gang, and he used to cultivate hatred and violence towards people, and that, you know, a few years back he was saved on such a day. He got his he became a Christian on such and such a day, or whatever. He didn't even use the word Christian. He just said it was his salvation, and he decided that love was the true path, and decided that, and now how much better his life was, that he just practices loving kindness for all living beings, and it's just really great. And so we decided that he was a true Christian, and so that was our whole meal that day. We walked into a redwood grove and sat, and we kind of couldn't even eat it at first. It was like we were just looking at it and thinking, this is a really, really pure offering. And so we started cutting the apples up, and we're eating apples and peanut butter and carrots and thinking, wow, you know, this is like one of the best meals I've ever had. And that was special. And I think there was a turning point with that offering, in that there was, it almost had a very sacred aspect to it. And it was very unexpected. And so, yeah, we camped again. That night we camped under the redwoods. We went to a day use area. We found the day use areas in the redwoods were good for us because nobody parks there after 8 p.m. So we went to this day use area, and we did some stealth camping, and we slept under the redwoods. And that was special too, because I've known every time I've gone to Montgomery Woods and seen these giant redwoods, I've thought, oh, I wonder what it would be like to actually, you know, meditate under these redwoods and spend the night under these redwoods. And so we got to have that experience, sleeping under the redwoods, and very quiet and very peaceful. So we kept walking through Avenue of the Giants to a little town called Miranda the next day. And, you know, another very small place. And we're preparing to go alms round in that town. It's maybe 10 a.m. And same thing. As soon as we had our robes on, somebody pulls up in a truck and he says, "Can I support you guys? Can I offer you guys some money?" And we said, "We don't accept money, but we do accept food. If you'd like to offer some food, we would accept that." And so he says, "I'll be right back." So he zooms off, comes back with a big bag full of power bars and Triscuits and like Kern's fruit drinks. And he says, I have a tab at a restaurant like 200 feet away from you guys. And go there and just get whatever you want. So so he goes and tells the owner of the restaurant. We go down to this restaurant. We have a huge meal. And it's still morning time, so that was kind of, we have a huge breakfast. And then we kept the power bars for just before 1 p.m. And that was also head shaving day. So we went by the Eel River. We had our power bars and Triscuits and shaved our heads. Camped under the redwoods again that day, but I have to back up a bit before camping, because this day we kept walking, and we got to a very tiny little town, which is about halfway through Avenue of the Giants, and it's called Myers Flat, and it's population 200. And so we put our robes on for walking through the town, and it's late afternoon, and we're walking through this town starting to think, where are we going to camp? And these kids come up to us and they say, my dad's Buddhist, you know, do you guys have any books or anything? And so we're like, well, no, but where's your dad? And so his dad eventually comes out, starts talking to us. His name's Roy. And he says, oh, I know, I've been practicing with Chagda Tolku. Have you ever heard that name before? And I said, yeah, we've heard that name before. And he said, oh, yeah, I've practiced with him for years at such and such a center away from here, you know, before I moved to Myers Flat. And why don't you guys come and have some tea? And can I offer you anything? And so he ended up offering cheese and tea and chocolate and allowables. And we ended up sitting at his house, which is on the main strip of Myers Flat, which is a very, very small town. I mean, the main strip is like four buildings. And so we're there chatting with him, talking. And he's just like, yeah, I'll take you anywhere you want, to a campground or anything. But he's asking Dhamma questions, and we're just having a really good discussion. His kids are around, his wife comes out, and we're just chatting with them. And then these two ladies walk up, and they're like, hello, we just saw some monks, and we were touring Avenue of the Giants, and we're Spirit Rock teachers, and we just saw some monks, and we thought, like, wow, there's monks in Avenue of the Giants, and can we hang out with you guys? And they're like, we're going to this Spirit Rock Teachers Conference tomorrow, but we had some time, so we were just touring Avenue of the Giants. And, you know, I forget their names, but I'm such and such from Buddha House in Germany, and, you know, the other lady introduces herself, and I'm a supporter of Amaravati. And so they come, and they sit at the table with us, and Roy offers them some water, and we just start, you continue our Dhamma discussion. And so by this time, I was thinking, wow, this is really interesting. Then this guy rides by on a bike, and he's like, hey, can I offer you something? And he tosses a lemon to us, and we catch it, and we thought, that's a valid offering if somebody tosses something. And so it's a really, like, we were thinking nothing's going to happen in Myers Flat, population 200, and all these things are happening. And so eventually the day's getting on, and Roy's saying, well, I should take you to a campground. And so we're bidding farewell to everybody. And Roy's saying, so you ladies are Dharma teachers, huh? And they're like, yeah, have you heard of Spirit Rock? And he's like, no, I've never heard of it. You know, everybody knows about Jack Kornfield. No, I've never heard that name before. And so I'm thinking, this is a really amazing crossing of universes. Him with a Tibetan background, or Theravada monks, and then Spirit Rock teachers all sitting at this table together. Really fascinating and highly unexpected. So he took us to another campground where it was a day use area, and we ended up going and sleeping under the redwoods again that day. And the next day, we started walking again, and that's when Doug and Beth found us and offered the meal. First, they offered breakfast, and we were sitting at a campsite, and then Roy, who we met the day before, comes up with his kids, and he's like, I just wanted to say goodbye to you guys. I really enjoyed meeting you. And, you know, so Doug and Beth got to meet him. And yeah, we had breakfast and starting to talk about what do we want to do. And Doug's like, oh, you know, this is really inspiring what you guys are doing. I'll offer you anything. What do you guys, you know, you guys want to do your laundry or something? Or he said, well, let's just drive north and see what happens. And so we ended up from there getting, Doug drove us to Eureka. And we went to a laundromat and dropped off a bunch of laundry. And Doug and Beth offered the meal. Yeah, and then Doug was keen to put us up in a hotel room. So we stayed at the Bayview Inn, Eureka, that night. And they also prepaid a meal for us at a cafe for the next morning. And the people at the cafe agreed to that. So Bayview Inn, we walked out the next day from Bayview Inn, out of Eureka. Well, we had the meal in Eureka and then walked out. And we thought, well, we're going to try to walk to Arcata today, and that's about 15 miles. So we didn't follow the 101. We went towards the ocean, followed, I think it was Highway 255 north. It was a 101 alternate. And so there's this huge bridge you have to go over to get to this other highway. And we're resting before we enter onto this bridge. We're resting under the bridge and using a bathroom that was there. And this Harley guy pulls up on a motorcycle, and he's kind of looking us up and down. And he comes up to us and he says, what are you guys doing? What's your story? And so so we say, well, we're Buddhist monks, and we're on a walking pilgrimage from Ukiah, California, to White Salmon, Washington. And we explain ourselves, and he's like, you know, how are you supporting yourselves? And he just started questioning us and asking about us. And he was interested in what we were doing. And also, he's a motorcycle guy, so he could relate to us as being on the road. And he started telling us that you know, you can expect in such and such a town, you know, you can expect this. And, you know, farther north, there's a lot of cults in Coos Bay, so be kind of careful in Coos Bay. There's a lot of cults there. And so he's just kind of explaining to us what we could expect on 101. And then Tanti Tapo makes a comment. He says, yeah, we can really see that America is a Christian nation. We're meeting a lot of Christians and a lot of people, you know, talking about Christianity to us. And he goes, ah, that's BS. He said, I belong to a church, but, you know, just the other side. We're like, what? And he was an older guy. He explained he was a Vietnam veteran, but then we notice he's wearing this like big amulet on his neck, and it's a huge like pentagram with these like glyphs on each point. And then we see 666 up the side, and he said, so he belongs to the Church of Satan. And he said, you know, a lot of people have misconceptions about the Church of Satan. he said, we don't sacrifice children and we don't harm people. He said, what we believe is that everybody has godliness in them, and that's, you know, according to most Christianity, it's heretical to believe that. So he started explaining that to us. But he was a really normal guy, and he was just, it was just so interesting. And then as we were talking to him, two young guys, kind of sporty-looking guys, football players or something, they're in jerseys, came up to us, and they're like, hey, you know, can we take our picture with you? And then this guy, the Church of Satan guy who we're talking to, he got very quiet, and he was staring at them. And it really felt like he was protecting us. Like he was like, if these guys, you know, mess with these monks, I'm going to, you know, beat them up or something. And it was really interesting. And so these guys, they just, you know, they took their picture with us, and they were nice to us. They said, you know, meeting monks, that's interesting. And you know, after this experience, Tanti Tapo and I look at each other, it's like, we have some very interesting forces on our side. No. And when we parted ways with this guy, he said, "Oh, I'd like to give you, you know, my business card." And he gave us this business card. It said "Old Coots on Scoots." It's kind of this motorcycle club. And then he said, "I'd like to give you my social card as well." And so neither of these cards had any contact information on them. And his social card was, all it was some writing on a blank white card. And it said, "You were cordially invited to the theological place of eternal punishment." And so that was like our get out of jail free card. If anything happened, we can go into the Church of Satan and present this card to them. And Tanti Tapo kept that card. I don't have it with me. He was really keen on keeping it. So that was interesting. And you know, every day was like this, but I'm going to have to skip forward a few days to what I think is the highlight of the Tudong. So we kept walking from there past Arcata. I mean, I have to say that in Arcata, we're walking out of Arcata. Yeah, we camped on the beach, then between some sand dunes, and then we walked through Arcata, got alms food in Arcata. Walking out of Arcata, just before we got back on the highway, this guy called us and he said, "Hey, can I offer you guys some tea or something?" And he was out checking his mail. So we went in and he took us into his home, and his name was Orion. And he said, "Yeah, I'm a Tai Chi teacher. And, you know, I'm just interested in monks. I'm interested in spirituality in general." And so we were talking, chatting with him. And he ended up giving us an hour-long Qigong lesson. So that was interesting, unexpected. And he ended up taking us to the next town, McKinleyville, maybe 5 miles north of Arcata, and he dropped us off at a point there. We kept walking. And so I'm going to have to jump forward a few days. We met some more amazing people on the way, but I can't talk about them here. And then we started walking north of a town called Trinidad. It's getting pretty far north from here. And we're walking on the old stagecoach road. It's a 101 alternate. It's the original 101. And it's really beautiful walk. And we're just walking towards a place called Patrick's Point. And this lady pulls up in a SUV, and she just says, "Oh, wow, you guys are monks. Can I offer you some tea, or can I help you in any way? And can I give you a ride somewhere?" And we said, "Well, yeah, sure, you can, yeah." And so she gave us a ride then to her house, which is kind of like she has a kuti, and then she has like another kuti for like meditation. And she turns out she's a practitioner. And it was kind of a resort, but it was a little bit run down because the owner of the resort, her husband, had died a year ago, and it was kind of, things were getting a bit run down. And so this lady, her name is Alina, she brought us into this resort where she lives, where she herself and her partner, Blair, they're living and working. She was working in exchange for lodging, so not receiving pay, but in exchange for being able to live there. And her husband is a graphic designer who commutes to Fortuna, quite a long commute each day. And so she took us in and offered us tea. There was a picnic table just outside of these kuti-type buildings. She offered us tea. She offered us some cheese and allowables and started chatting with us and explained that she's just really impressed with what we're doing. But actually, we didn't get to talk with her so much at first because this VW bug pulls up and this British guy gets out, long hair, kind of guy in his early 40s, British traveler, hippie type. And he's like, "Hey, monks, can I talk to you guys?" And so Alina says, "Oh yeah, you're welcome to have tea with us." So he comes up and has tea with us, and he starts chatting with us for a long time. And so eventually he leaves. And yeah, it was just really interesting meeting this guy. He had traveled in India, told us about his life. But so then from then we, Alina said, well, can I offer you a place to stay? I've got this little cabin, which I don't live in, but I use it only for spirituality and for meditation. And so we said, well, sure, yeah, we'll stay there. And we start finding out more about this lady. And it turns out that she had spent a long time in northern Minnesota with on a Native American reservation. They're called the Ojibwe people. And she had spent 7 years living with them as a counselor for their kids, and they took her into their tribe. She was the only white person living there at the time. Her partner chose to live outside of the reservation. And yeah, they took her in. She was part of their life for 7 years. Then just last year, the government cut their funding and they weren't able to employ her anymore. And she then came to California. And a family she had a strong connection with there were peace pipe carriers. And for people who don't know about the Native American peace pipe tradition, their life revolves around the peace pipe, and it's an object of which is sacred to them, and an object of prayer and devotion, which when they smoke either tobacco, sage, there's different mixtures, when they smoke out of it, they make a prayer or dedicating merit and virtue, blessings. And so before Alina left the tribe, this family presented her with a peace pipe. And if you're presented with a peace pipe, then you're in the lineage of peace pipe holders. So she was a peace pipe holder. And also something that they had given her is a little Native American doll. And it's small, made out of hide, leather, has real human hair on it, and it's faceless. And this is the first thing that children receive from their mothers in this tribe. And it's kind of symbolic, faceless. You can become anything in your life. And so they had given her, as like a gesture of adopting her into this tribe, they had given her one of these dolls because that's what they give their children. So she also had this little doll. And we're thinking, yeah, this... that's quite special. And so I had never even seen a peace pipe before. And so we're able to see the peace pipe there on her altar. And so we ended up staying there for a night. And she offered the meal the next day. And then we were talking with her about, well, what's our plan next? Where do we want to get to next? And she was saying, well, the highway north of here is, there's not much. And can I give you a ride somewhere? And we said, well, you know, Ajahn Sudanto wants to meet us in a couple days in Northern California, and it might be nice if we get to the Klamath area and if we're camping there, that would be a convenient place for Ajahn Sudanto and the Portland group to meet us. And so she said, well, I have a stipend which comes in each month, and that should be enough for me to have gas money to get you guys up to Klamath. It's maybe 40 miles. But they're living paycheck to paycheck, and they didn't have much money. So we decided to stay another night there. And that day we were kind of making a plan, and we went with her back into Trinidad, and she took us out for coffee. And she goes to the post office. She's like, well, my check didn't come. I don't know what we're going to do. And so... then we went for coffee, and then she said, well, let's go for a walk on the beach. I want to show you guys some of the local area. So we're walking out of this cafe and then going to go down to this beach, and then I hear this voice, Yaniko! Yaniko! And then I look over, and it's Sam Halsted, our plumber. And this is like, you know, this is like 250 miles north of here. And, and it's not even on the highway. It's in a little town. And he's like, wow, you know, can I offer you something? Can I offer you support? Some, you know, wow, great to see you. And so we said, well, you know, Alina needs some gas money to take us to Klamath tomorrow. So he's like, all right. And he's giving her gas money. And we chatted with him for a bit. It was just uncanny timing because she really needed that gas money to take us up north. And so on a certain level, she became part of the Tudong temporarily there. So we stayed another night at her place. And the next day, she offered us the meal again. Then after the meal, she took us to Klamath. And before leaving, though, she offered us this little Native American doll that had been given to her. So that was, so we then were gifted with that. So she ended up taking us to Mystic Forest RV park and campground in Klamath. And she paid for a campsite. It's a very nice campground. And that worked out really well because the very next day then we were able to contact Ajahn Sudanto. He was coming down. They made it in time for the meal, and the Portland group offered the meal. We had a picnic that day and got to meet up with Ajahn Sudanto, Tanchaganando, Tankasapo. We all had the meal there together in the campground. And then the group ended up, I think it was Scott Benge himself, ended up getting us another night at the campground. And so we spent the afternoon meditating. And the Portland group had also prepaid a meal at a restaurant about a mile north of the campground the next day. And so it's interesting being at this campground too, because both mornings we were there, other campers came by and spontaneously offered us breakfast and coffee and wanted to chat with us. So our second morning there, this guy comes by and he just, you know, without really knowing, you know, what we're doing or who we are, he just comes by with a big bowl of fresh strawberries and coffee and half and half. And we're like, okay. And he just sits down and starts talking to us. And he says, yeah, I live in Eureka and, you know, I just wanted to hang out with you guys. So, you know, can I offer you guys some of this stuff? And so we had coffee with him and we're talking for a little while, chatting, and he's just happy to meet us. And after we started walking again, went to this restaurant, had our prepaid meal at the Forest Cafe in Klamath. Waitress is Native American, and start chatting with her a bit, and she's kind of asking us, you know, what are we doing, and wishing us well on our journey. And before I go on to the next part of the story, I have to say that before going on the walk, Tanti Tapo and I were both thinking, you know, what do we want to dedicate this walk to? And there has to be some sort of dedication or sharing of merit, sharing of blessings. And for myself, of course, what came up first is sharing the merit with my parents, but also for both of us was, Ajahn Jodhi Paulo as well, we've been talking for the last year about how can we share merit and blessings with the Native Americans. And so that was also very strong in our consciousness coming into these areas in Northern California that we do want to be sharing blessings and merit with the Native Americans and just making that very conscious. And so that day we walked really far. We made it to Crescent City that day, just south of Crescent City, camped on the beach. Next day, got alms food in Crescent City. Alms food in Crescent City was a bit of a highlight because it was the first Asian person we saw the whole time. We thought we would see a lot more Thais and Asian people, but we hadn't seen any Asian people. All of our support was coming from Americans, from Westerners. So a Vietnamese lady, we suspect from the nail salon nearby, came out and offered us some sandwiches. So we walked on from there, and we're walking north of Crescent City. and we're using a 101 alternate. There was a road called Lake Earl Drive. It's next to 101, and we're thinking we can walk this road instead of 101. It's a lot more peaceful, and then it meets up with 101 at this point, you know, 8 miles ahead or something. So we're thinking it's afternoon. We're going to walk this road and just see where we come to, see if we can maybe stay on the beach again or something. So we're walking on this road, and we've been walking for a few hours, and a Native American guy riding a bicycle rides past us, and then he stops and he turns around, and so then he rides up to us. And we could see he's slightly swerving, slightly inebriated guy, but he's kind of looking at us, and he says, "You guys look really interesting. Are you looking for a place to stay tonight?" And we said, "Well, yeah, we are." And he said, "Well, me and my two brothers have 28 acres of land just on a side road up ahead. We'd be really, really happy to have you guys there tonight." And he said, "We drink a lot. But we'd be really happy to have you guys. And you'd be safe there." Yeah, he said, we drink a lot, but you'll be safe." And so we said, "Okay." And so he goes to the store to get more alcohol. And then he comes back and meets us on this road that he told us about and walks his bike with us, shows us where his land, and walks into his land there. And so he lives on this land with his two brothers. They're in their, the guy who saw us, his name's Buddy, and he's in his early 60s. His younger brother there is a really beyond alcoholic. And I forget what his name was, but he kept telling us, this man himself kept telling us his name was NSA. So, but he could barely speak or barely even move from alcoholism. And then the third brother wasn't there yet, but he rolled up within the hour. He rolled up with a white guy, an older guy, and who was driving him around. So they came up. Third brother's name was Happy. And he was the oldest brother, I believe. So we're talking and chatting with these guys, and they're really going on and on about our robes, and they're saying, you know, the color of those robes, we really love your robes, and just the courage that it takes to, you know, walk and, you know, proudly wear those clothes in this society. That's just, you know, worthy of our praise and admiration. So we're talking and chatting with them, and then we said, "Well, we'd like to do some paritta chanting. We'd like to do a blessing ceremony for you and for your land." And so they were into that, and we didn't do much chanting. We chanted the Metta Sutta and the Bojango as well, and we didn't want to make it too long because we weren't sure how receptive they would be to it. But they sobered up really fast, and they were really nearly in tears. And then Buddy was telling us, you know, "That's like the best thing that's happened to us all year." And then his brother Happy is like, "That's the best thing that's ever happened to us." So they were really moved by that. And then they're like, "Well, you know," they started telling us that, you know, our mother told us that, you know, she wanted us to build a teepee village on this land, but we're just alcoholics. And, you know, we were saying, "Well, there's still time, you know, you can still do that." And so they're just, you know, it became much deeper at that point. And then Tanti Tapu had remembered that Alina had given us this little Native American doll. So he said, "Oh, we have something for you." So he pulled out the doll, and I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. Give the doll to these guys. So he gave the doll to them. And then Buddy, the guy who found us on his bike, he's just saying, "Oh my, this reminds me of my mother. She made one of these exact dolls for each of her 9 children, and she kept them in a little baggie." And he's just completely in tears at this point. And the other brothers are kind of like, "We have to give them something. We have to give them a gift." So they're kind of going into their house, looking around, and Happy comes out carrying this Native American male warrior's necklace, and they gift that to us, and they explain that it was given to them from their father, and then it was even given to their father, so it was quite old, probably maybe between 50 and 80 years old, and they explain that it was from South Dakota, the Lakotas there, the Jumping Eagle clan, and it was quite quite special. So we didn't stay there that night. We didn't quite feel comfortable if they were gonna, you know, get blacked out drunk or something. But they were telling us, you know, you guys have come home. You're Native Americans. We consider you Native Americans, and you're part of our family, and you're always welcome on the reservation. And we're gonna take you to our cousin's house. Her name is Vicky. You know, she doesn't drink, and you can meet her, and she's kind of the good one of us who doesn't do drugs or drink. And so, I'm saying, well, you know, I might have a smidgen of Native American blood, but I'm not Native American. And Tanti Tapo is saying, well, you know, I'm probably 1/8 or 1/16 Native American, but not, you know, not really. And, you know, they told us, you know, being Native American has nothing to do with your blood. Those robes you guys are wearing, just don't even, you can't wear those robes and tell me that you're white. He said, you are proudly wearing our colors, and we consider you Native American. So the white guy who was with them, he had a truck, and then Happy drove with us, and we got in with them, and they took us to Vicky's place, their cousin. So we went to her place. It's a reservation neighborhood, a lot of poor people, and we decided we felt safe there to stay on her front lawn. And Vicky was living there with her daughter, who had, and when she was younger, had destroyed her mind with heroin and methamphetamines, but had recovered, but can't function very well, can only follow basic commands, but was living there with her mother. And also very good-hearted, but just very, very sad to see. And so they left us there with Vicky, and she's a bit older, probably late 60s, early 70s. Yeah, she's told us some just heartrending stories about her life and about the Native Americans in general. And I won't go into detail, but she had a very, very difficult life. And also her own mother, who was like the matriarch of their tribe, which is the Talawa Indians of Smith River. Her mother had died last year. And after that, the family kind of fell apart, in addition to the methamphetamines and alcoholism, which is rampant in the reservations. And so none of her relatives are really helping her out, and she has very serious back problems and knee problems and leg problems and can barely walk. So she's almost crippled, and nobody's cleaning her house for her. Her daughter can't do very much. On the reservation, it's a sovereign nation, so what that means is they take care of everything themselves. So simple things like trash pickup isn't provided for them, so the trash cans are just overflowing. And her nephew lives right next door. He's well-to-do, has a good job, doesn't help her out. You know, there's division in the tribe. The well-to-do Native Americans don't want to associate with the poor ones. And so it's just quite sad. The dance hall for their tribe was on her land because her mother was kind of the matriarch. And the dance hall was on their land, but it had been padlocked for 9 years because Vicky's brother, who was supposed to be the tribal chief, has a lot of influences pulling him out of doing the traditional dances and ceremonies. So he hasn't, and he's the one with the key to this padlock. So the dance hall is closed for 9 years now. And they also had a cemetery on this land that we stayed on. And yeah, just quite sad to see. And Vicky was telling us about the old Native American ways and their laws. They said they used to have very strict laws. In summary, you could say it almost to the letter followed the five precepts. And also, she explained to us that the Native Americans, before the settlers from Europe arrived, they're one of the few cultures in the world that never that didn't have alcohol in any form in their culture. So most cultures in Asia, India, everywhere, they had alcohol for thousands of years, but the Native Americans didn't have alcohol in any form, and that seems to be a reason why it's had such a strong effect on them. And they just don't have the DNA to deal with alcohol. So she was explaining that to us, and she told us the story of her mother, and I'm probably not getting everything completely right about this, but the way I remember it is her mother was auctioned at the age of 12. This would be the early 1900s. She was auctioned to someone for a bag of rice. She was bought for a bag of rice by a 70-year-old man, bought her for a bag of rice, and she was 12. And they had 9 children, and then he died. And so the children don't really know their father. And then the mother was like this matriarch, devoted her whole life to helping Native Americans and doing what she could to keep the culture together. So she was telling us stories like that, saying, "Yeah, us Native Americans, we've seen it all. You know, rape, murder, you know, killing babies, we've seen it all." And so it's just incredible just to hear that first person from somebody. Very, very powerful. But this lady was special. She was very clear-headed, really, really strong will, really holding it together, even though nobody was helping her out. So we stayed the night in her yard. She offered a very large meal the next day. We thought we must do something for her because we want to help the Native Americans somehow. This is the least we can do. So we cleaned her kitchen, washed all the pots and pans. Just if we were to clean the house, it would have been an endless project. But the least we could do was we cleaned the kitchen counters, cleaned her windows, and tidied up a bit. She was very, very grateful. And we did some chanting for her. And leaving her, it was like, you know, may your relatives help you out more. I mean, may your tribe be harmonious with one another. So it was afternoon by the time we were packing up our stuff and leaving her place. And so right as we're packing up, we're getting ready to walk down the road back towards 101. This is on the south side of the Smith River. A big white truck pulls up. And it's another Native American guy, but more the well-to-do class, not the poor class. And he says, "Are you guys lost?" And we said, "No, we stayed with Vicky, allowed us to stay on her front lawn last night, and she fed us a big meal, and she looked after us. We explained ourselves, we don't use money, we're on this walking pilgrimage." He said, "I've seen some crazy stuff go down in this neighborhood, and this is like a rough, rough neighborhood, and you know, you never see white people here, and you guys like are not safe here. Can I give you a ride back to 101? And so he said, "Well, okay." So, and then we're riding with him, and he's like, "You guys have got to be kidding me. You stayed on that land, and these people are crazy." And he's like, "I know that lady, and she's crazy." And we're like, "We know she's not crazy. You can't be crazy and cook a meal that good, and talk to us." You know, but it's these perceptions, and it's you know, he must have seen things in the past that, yeah, there was, you know, this lady, Vicky, she had abusive husbands in the past who passed away now, but, and, you know, her children have drug addiction, alcoholism. So yeah, he has seen some crazy stuff there, but he hadn't seen the goodness there. And so he gives us a ride, very short ride back to 101. And he's like, you guys are walking here. Get out of Smith River as fast as possible. You do not want to associate with these people. And he's like, how did you find out? How did you get to her house? And we told him about the three brothers. He's like, I know those guys. And like, you do not want to associate with those guys. And we're like, well, that was like one of the most amazing experiences, if not the most amazing experience of our pilgrimage. We didn't tell him that, but we're like, all right, you know, thank you. And he's like, and don't drink the Smith River water. You'll get Girardia, you know. It's like, he was just really worried about us. And we're like, thank you for your concern. And so we kept walking from there. And then it started raining. And so that was the first time we used our glots, our umbrellas. We made use of our umbrellas. Walking in the rain, it was pretty late already. We were walking for a few more hours. It was maybe 8:30 p.m. And yeah, we're thinking, well, where are we going to go? It looks like there's no place to camp, but we were having a good time walking in the rain, just continuing on north. And then this lady pulls up beside us, and she says, like, you guys, I passed you guys going the other way, and you're walking in the rain. You guys have a place to stay tonight? So we said, well, no. She said, well, you know, I'm an owner of this lily bulb, the biggest lily bulb plantation in the world, just up ahead. And so I have a house on that land. My son has a house, and my mother has a house. My mother passed away last year. My mother's house is empty. Would you like to stay there? So we're like, okay. So she takes us up to this huge house, and it's empty, but beautiful house. And she said, take the shower, use the laundry, anything you want. You can make use of this house. And so we're talking and chatting with her, and she's asking, you know, well, where did you stay last night? And then we start telling her about these Native Americans that we stayed with. And we said, well, we stayed with Vicky, this lady named Vicky. And she said, was it Vicky Bommelaine? And we had her address written down. And it was like, looking at the address, I said, yeah, it was. It was Vicky Bommelaine. And she said, well, I was born and raised here, and I went to school since I was 5 with Vicky Bommelaine, and she's a really amazing person, and you can completely trust her. And she's like, she's a really good friend of mine, and she's had a really hard life, but that's amazing that you guys got to meet her, and she's a really, that's a really important family in that tribe. And so there you go again, flipping back to the other perception. And so, yeah, she was really, really happy to look after us, this lady. Her name was Caroline. So we stayed there, got out of the rain, really big house, really comfortable amenities. Then the next morning she came by with a breakfast. She didn't offer the meal, but gave us a breakfast, some food we could take with us on the road. You know, went down and chatted with her and her husband and her family down at the lily bulb factory place down at the bottom of the plantation. Her house was up on a hill. Went down to the bottom, chatted with her, and everybody was really interested. Talked with them for maybe an hour or so. Then we kept walking, and we were looking at the map, thinking we're almost in Oregon, and the next big town is Brookings. So it's pretty far, but it seems doable. We're going to try to get to Brookings and go alms around there. I'm thinking it looks like it's maybe 10 miles, maybe, you know, 8 miles to the Oregon border, maybe another two to Brookings. But looking at a map, it's really hard to tell, especially when you're walking. So we're walking, and we're really not sure when we're going to get to Brookings. So we're walking pretty fast, and we're like, oh, this is getting pretty far, and time is, you know, the morning is wearing away. And we get to the Oregon border, and we're thinking, yeah, on the map here it says Brookings is just, just past the Oregon border. So let's prepare for Alms Round. We put our take our bowls out of our bags and prepare for going Alms Round at the Oregon border. And then we keep walking. And then it's like walking, 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 and we're not getting to Brookings. And we're walking, and it's like 11:30, 11:45, you know, 12. And it's just endless rolling hills. And it's like, you know, wow, this is, technically we're in Brookings, but like there's no markets or anything. This is just farms really far away. And so it was getting really close to midday. And we were thinking, well, what's going to happen? So the first food type place we come to, we're thinking we're going to have to stop at the first anything that we come to. And the first food type place is a Shell station with a Quickie Mart. So we're like, well, it's getting really close to the cutoff of where we can eat. So we just have no choice. We're going to have to stand here. So we go and stand at this Shell station, and it's kind of an uncomfortable situation. It wasn't really in the Redwoods like the other gas station we got food at. It was, you know, in the middle of kind of the outskirts of the city, and yeah, kind of just felt strange. And this guy walks by us, and he looks at us, he says, "I don't need anything from you guys," and then just keeps walking. And okay, and then the owner or the manager of this Shell station comes out, and he says, "Look, you know, if you guys could please, you know, I can't allow you guys to stand here, but you can stand here a couple more minutes." We're like, "That's strange. We can't stand here, but we can stand here a couple more minutes." And so we're thinking, "Well, let's stand a couple more minutes," and then nobody engages us. We said, "Well, you know, it's pretty far into the middle of Brookings. We're not going to eat today," and we gave up hope at that point. And so we're like, well, let's just keep walking. So we kept walking, and then there's this lady standing on the sidewalk not far after this Shell station, and she's standing there, and she's waiting for us. And so we get up to her, and she says, "Can I offer you some money? Have you eaten yet today?" And we said, "No, we haven't eaten." She says, "Can I offer you money to get the meal?" And we said, "Well, we don't accept money." And she's like, "Well, you know, I'm associated with the Shasta Abbey community. Do you know them?" And we said, "Yeah, we know them." So she said, "Well, you know, I'm a disciple of one of the monks there. And he's a really good friend and a teacher. And I know a good restaurant. I can, you know, get in my car. I'll take you guys to a restaurant." So she takes us into Brookings to this cafe, Gallery Grill. It's above this gallery. She takes us in, gets us a meal very quickly. We explain to her it's very close to the cutoff when we can't eat anymore. So she then explains it to them, puts it on her tab. We get a really big meal, and we had completely given up hope of eating a meal that day, and we got like a really, really big meal that day. So then after the meal, she comes back to us. She says, "Look, you know, I've got these friends who own this shop. It's called Gypsies. My friend Kid, she really wants to meet you guys. If you guys could have tea," she said, she doesn't know yet, but she'd really like to have tea with you. So we go into this. It's like the only way I can explain it is like it's a New Age tarot crystal Reiki shop, and so we go in there, and there's a table there, and Kid, the owner's there, and she welcomes us, and you know, she serves us tea, and we're sitting there and having tea and chatting, and then people are coming in and sitting down, and she's introducing us to all of her friends, and then her daughter-in-law works there and does tarot readings, and so she comes up and starts talking to us, and then it turns out they were at the Dalai Lama's teachings in Portland recently, and it just keeps going and going, and then eventually it's like, "So where are you guys going to stay tonight?" And I was like, "Well, we don't know." And they're like, "Well, we have a huge studio right above the shop. It's empty. Like, please stay there." So we end up going above this shop and staying in this really spacious, really nice studio apartment. You know, laundry, anything we want, hot shower, laundry facilities. And so then they said, you know, please, you know, come to our house and meet our family. So that evening we go have tea at their house. We meet. So this family, Kid, K-I-D-D, she's the owner of this shop, Gypsies. And then her son, Andy, he lives in the same house, and his wife, Brindle, she also works as a tarot card reader at this shop, and they live together in this big house, this kind of complex on the up on these hills in Brookings. So we meet the whole family. Andy and Brindle had lived in White Salmon for 9 months, so they knew where we were going, and White Salmon's not a very big place, so that was a really interesting connection. So they knew where we were going, and we're chatting, having tea with them, and then they want to offer breakfast the next day, so we go, you know, have breakfast there at this house, and then we went alms around in Brookings. That was the first time we saw Thai people. Was we walked by a Thai restaurant in Brookings, and on the way back, past the Thai restaurant again, the people invited us in, and so we had the meal there. Talked and chatted with the Thai people. They said, "Oh, you know, my relative has a restaurant in Coos Bay. You have to go there when you're going through." So, you know, from there, every relative had the next Thai restaurant. So that was fun. And I can't even go into those stories because I've been talking for a while now. So then we had the meal. And then we actually had way too much food that day, because on that alms round we had gotten offered tons of fruit, and we didn't even eat any of that because of the Thai food. So we went back to Gypsies. We said, "Okay, fruit for everyone." And we just gave them fruit, and then everybody coming in was eating all this fruit, and they're like, "Oh, wow, okay." And so, and they all the customers coming in, they're like, "Hey, you want some fruit?" And they're kind of giving them fruit. It's really nice. And so we ended up staying another night there because there was more people they wanted us to meet, and we ended up going to their house in the evening and doing some paritta chanting, having a group meditation at their house, and a Dhamma discussion, and then the next day they took us to Gold Beach, which is north of Brookings, and we thought, yeah, we'll keep walking from Gold Beach. So they gave us a sack lunch that day, you know, got us some coffee, and we said our goodbyes. We had lunch in Gold Beach, and from Gold Beach we were looking at the map. And the next big town was Port Orford, which is 28 miles. And there was a very little town called Ophir halfway, but everybody was telling us there's nothing in Ophir. So if you're going to go alms around, you're going to go alms around in Port Orford. So we're like, okay, well, we got to walk far today. So from Gold Beach, we walked and walked and walked, and that was our longest day of walking. It was about 17 miles. And it was getting dark. We were actually really hoping for a ride because that was really far, and we're thinking we're not going to make it for alms round. And so it's starting to get dark, and this guy stops. There wasn't many people on the highway even. And this guy stops, big red truck, and he calls out to us. He's like, "You don't see many monks in Louisiana." And he takes a picture of us and then speeds off. So we're like, we were literally staggering at this point because we walked so far. And so we're like, okay, and I wish he would have given us a ride. But so we keep walking. We got past this Ophir place. There was nothing. We keep walking, and it's getting dark. And we're kind of standing on the highway thinking, well, it's getting dark, and there's a cliff on our left, and there's a huge hill on our right. Where are we going to stay? I thought, well, let's just keep walking. So it's like 9:30 p.m., And there's a turnout on our left. We're walking against the flow of traffic, so we're walking on the left side of the highway. Turnout on our left. There's a little trail going over a little hill. And we're like, well, let's just walk over that little hill and see what there is. So we walk over this little hill, and there's a nice flat camping spot with a cliff next to it, and just picturesque Oregon coast leading up. Incredibly beautiful. No wind, very comfortable. So ideal camping spot, and almost full moon, really clear night. We lay out our sleeping bags there and just go to sleep. And the next day we got up, started walking again, and we didn't make it. So that was the day we didn't eat. We got it to a place called Humbug Mountain, and there's a kind of a campground there. So our only chance was to try to go alms around to the campground, but we go into the campground. There was almost nobody there. We just thought, this isn't going to work. And we kind of, in an act of desperation, because we were very, very, very hungry this day, and we stood next to the camp host trailer, and eventually the camp host came out and asked if she could help us, and we didn't really tell what we were doing, but she said, well, if you guys like, you can refill your water bottles here. And that was about it. And so all that we had was a jar of molasses. So we kind of pulled out this jar of molasses and we're just looking at it. And Tanti Tapo was saying, this is harsh. This is just harsh. This is just too harsh. And because at that point we'd walked like 23 miles since the last meal. And so we ate about half the jar of molasses, and then we're just like, enough of this, let's just keep walking. So we kept walking, and then there was this huge gust of wind on the highway going against us, and we're just staggering against this wind and walking up the highway, and it's just the sun, and we're thinking, this is just miserable. And then we're 3 miles before Port Orford, we could see it, and this guy pulls over on the highway. He's like, hey, can I give you guys a ride? I live in Port Orford. We're like, well, okay. And he's like, I'll take you guys to a place to stay. I'm a chiropractor I live here, and anything you guys want. I was just in Thailand. I recognize you guys. I was just on a trip in Thailand, and I know about monks. Is there any way I can support you? And it was like, okay, well, yeah. We didn't tell him we didn't eat that day, but we just said, well, you know, we're looking for a place to stay. So he took us to this Zen-style kind of similar to the place where Alina lives. It's like they had kutis, little cabins, but as a resort. And it's in a very beautiful forest. And so he took us there. And then the owners are quite spiritual also. So the owners were very happy to see us and very happy to offer their place to us free of charge. And eventually in chatting with this chiropractor guy, his name was Doc. That was his nickname anyway. And these people who are the owners of the resort, eventually they find out we didn't eat that day. So they're very like, well, we have to make sure you eat tomorrow. And so they put us up. It was very comfortable. Really, really nice to have a good place to stay. And then gave us breakfast the next morning. And actually, the group in Brookings knew people in the next town after Port Orford, which was called Langloy. And they had a friend there who owns the main market, who really wanted to meet us and possibly offer a meal. So that's how we were going to get the meal after being in this kind of Zen-style resort. So we had a big breakfast. Doc then took us to Langloy, to this market, and we parted ways with him there. And then we go into this market, and this young guy, right away, he's like, come on, I'll make you guys anything you want. And so we'd barely met him, and he's just like offering us all this food. And so then we started talking. We ate first and then started talking to him. He got us ice creams. He was just really happy to support us. He ended up giving us a tour of the town. He's a local there. His father owns the market, but he just inherited it from his father. And then I was kind of telling him, well, you know, the next place we're going is Bandon, because I think I have an uncle who lives there, but I'm not sure. And so then, by a strange set of circumstances, he's driving us to Bandon. I call my mom on this guy's phone, and my mom says, I'm emailing your uncle right now to say that you're going to be in the area. You know, and I said, well, what's their phone number? So she gives me their phone number. So I call my uncle, you know, my aunt answers, his wife answers. And I'm like, where do you guys live? We're in Langlois right now. And they're like, well, we actually live in Langlois. So he turns around really fast. And it turns out he knows them. They're regulars at the market. So he completely knows them, and he takes us to their house. They recognize each other. I haven't seen this uncle since I was 17. And so he ends up putting us up for the night, and we reconnect, make a connection with him. There's much more of the same happening until we get to White Salmon, Washington. But my voice is getting slightly hoarse, and that's probably, I could probably say that in summary, that going Tudong in America with Tanti Tapo was just a very incredible experience, to the point that I could say that it was very sacred to the both of us, and that it's not just on Tudong, but what this highlights for me is just exactly what it means to be a monk, because really we're living like this in the monastery, and we're living in that same way without asking for things and not using money. And this monastery is very well supported, but especially in the beginning, it was like Tudong, and our life very much is a Tudong, and everything is always uncertain. But a practice of walking like this just highlights that uncertainty that's always there. And when we live in that uncertainty, then from that moment becomes sacred within that uncertainty. And that's where true blessings are generated and can be shared out to the people we meet and shared out to the world, really. So I'll end there, and perhaps as the days go on, more of the stories which I didn't voice here will come out.